Create Intelligent Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi and welcome to the 81st episode of Robots. My name is Jana, and in today's episode, we'll be hearing from Dr. Newton Howard from the MIT, who's currently leading the Mind Machine Project, an initiative that attempts to develop intelligent robots. But first, let's get the latest news in the world of robotics from Christine. In a speech to robotics researchers at Carnegie Mellon University, US President Obama has announced the launch of an advanced manufacturing partnership. The initiative's main drive is to improve the U.S. domestic manufacturing capabilities by creating partnerships between industry, universities, and the federal government. Starting in 2012, the government-wide initiative will distribute a yearly $500 million U.S. dollars through agencies including the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, Energy, Agriculture, and Commerce, as well as the National Science Foundation, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, National Institutes of Health, and the Department of Agriculture for projects with industry. $70 million U.S. dollars out of the $500 million are dedicated to the goal of establishing U.S. leadership in next-generation robotics. While this will hardly be enough to revolutionize robotics manufacturing, it is an important first step. In addition, the report at the basis of the current initiative calls for the funding level to double over the next 4 years, with some funds drawn from existing programs as appropriate. Researchers at Delft University of Technology and Philips Research in the Netherlands have investigated if simple vacuum cleaner robots can convey personality traits. As outlined in a paper, the researchers first selected 5 desirable personality traits: calm, talkative, likes routines, bold, and systematic. In a second step, they asked a group of human actors to move like robots and act out typical robot vacuum cleaner behaviors, like cleaning a dirty spot, for each of the 5 personalities. In a third step, the human behaviors were replayed on a real robot. A panel of 15 people then rated the robot's personality. The panel was indeed able to successfully discern the 5 personality traits, illustrating that even a very simple robot can convey personality. For more information on this episode's news, including details on Obama's announcement of the Advanced Manufacturing Partnership and Delft University's research on robot vacuum cleaner personalities, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com. Launched by an initial 7-year multi-million dollar gift, the Mind Machine Project aims to integrate natural and machine intelligence to create autonomous intelligent robots. Working at the interface of brain and cognitive sciences, artificial intelligence, computer science, and a number of other fields, this project brings together a wide range of specialities, with researchers working in teams on 4 distinct categories: mind, body, memory, and intent. The Mind Machine Project is directed by Dr. Newton Howard, who holds a doctoral degree in cognitive informatics and mathematics, and has worked at a number of prestigious universities worldwide, including the Sorbonne, Oxford, and George Washington University. Our reporter Sabine met Dr. Howard at the MIT.
Hi, Newton. Welcome to Robots.
Hi, Sabina.
Tell me about the Mind Machine Project. What's the goal and motivation?
So, our initial goal was to investigate the real meaning of intelligence, where the emergent property of intelligence reside, and what did we do wrong in the last 50 years of AI, and how we could possibly correct it. I'm not sure if we actually can, but we tried.
Who's involved in this project?
It is a cross-institute collaboration. We had people from CSIL, Brain and Cox Eye, engineering, bioengineering, and medical engineering, Center of Bits and Atoms, and a couple other institutions around the U.S. and overseas, to include Sorbonne in Paris, University of Geneva, University of Wisconsin. I can't remember the other one. Yeah, that's it. Boston University. Yeah.
You mentioned that the motivation for this project was that we've been doing AI wrong for the last 50 years. What was wrong with the AI until now?
I don't believe we quite understood what is intelligence. For example, I say that if we actually did, in fact, model human intelligence, and we were able to achieve that in the current state of art, then we are facing some serious paradoxes, because we interpreted what is human or natural intelligence in a completely different manner than what it is. I used in one critique of AI, if we were to use the classical way we think of intelligence today, we would probably not think that Einstein was very, very intelligent, because his speed of processing was relatively slow, he had disabilities, arithmetic wasn't all that great. So how is it that with such difficulties you produced a genius? Yet, in the most sophisticated form of machines that implement or based on what do we call what we so call AI today, they can't do the most basics of functions. I mean, they certainly can do an amazing job at substantial tasks, but nothing that resembles the common sense of a child.
So what's the problem? Is it that we didn't understand what human intelligence was?
I suspect that von Neumann and the Turing test and the von Neumann architecture did not quite get it right.
So it's like starting on the wrong foot.
Yes, but sure, we produced great achievements in the world of software and the machine and computation and so forth, but it doesn't amount to much in relation to the real discovery of the human genius.
So in your pursuit of intelligence, you've been looking at different areas: the mind, the body, memory, the brain, and intent. Why put these different areas together? How do they cross-link?
Right, so though we actually postured in a way that shows a division between these different areas, we believe that the whole Cartesian duality and the whole separation really didn't serve science very well. If we learn about the inner working of these would seemingly be separate areas, we in fact would discover that the working mechanism and the process ontology of the entire manifestation is actually one and the same. And it's far more elegant than anything we're ever able to implement to date.
So how do you go about studying something so cross-disciplinary? In each one of these fields, are you actually trying to get specific goals, or are you really focusing on the connections between these areas?
So the short answer is to maintain extreme focus. The long answer is that each discipline come at the answer from a different perspective and skill set and tool set and paradigm. When they converge, we are able to actually see at a higher resolution the nature of intelligence, the emergence of consciousness, and what makes us as human what we are, and the originality of that human genius.
Can you give us some concrete examples of what we should see in these fields to sort of get maybe to the emergence of consciousness?
So MMP is set within a center, a collaborator called the Center for Bits and Atoms. And here there's efforts in basically reinventing the very concept of material meeting computation, where we are building consciousness from the ground up, built into the material. Part of the goals for this year, we actually broke the project into two phases. The first one we called it MMP 1.0, and in that phase we looked at the current state of the discipline to establish a state of departure. We concluded, and there was concrete focus in that space where we looked at cognitive agents and tools. And various programming tools. One in particular was called the Propagator. It was led by a postdoc from CSEL, and looking at the space of this cognitive hardware or reconfigurable asynchronous logic automata, and the basics of brain science, and what we can learn from projects like Connectum, that is led by a professor here named Sven Sein. And in year one, we basically concluded that these limitations still exist, not only actually in the tool, but in the mind of the researchers and in the mind of the people in the field. The majority of classic AI thinkers, they have a particular way of navigating the problem set and refuse to look any other way about it. Particular group here that was working on common sense computation, where the approach is, it resembles how we built the concept from the ground up and the formation of reaching a decision based on the learned experience, the ethnomethodology of practice of a given human, and they developed a substantial amount of tools and know-how to influence that particular way of achievement. Most to the credit of the work of Professor Minsky and his proposition in basically rebooting AI and going in that direction.
I find it really interesting that it's hard for the scientists to sort of get out of their box, get out of doing AI in the typical way. What is needed? Is it because science is not taught in the right way so that we can think in things maybe outside of a very specific problem, but more in a more general way? Or
so, going back to this, Cartesian way of thinking, it isn't that the education or the technical education manifest a substantial amount of skills that can be used to address a whole host of challenges and paradoxes and questions. It is particularly being able or allow yourself to be creative. It is somewhat of an intriguing phenomenon that thinkers and AI tend to reform into becoming more robotics than informing robotics to be more intelligent. Yes, and that's just basically a habit of practice and other administrative fears that on resources and the next state of their career and whatnot than it is of science. I think the problem is social than science.
I have to ask, what's a conscious material?
So a material that is built from the ground up would exhibit intelligent behavior. Here's a concrete example actually that we're looking at. So the brain and the structure of the brain and breaking down the 3D structure into folds that don't make sense. So, for example, if I was evolution and I took this napkin and I wrinkle this napkin and I just keep wrinkling it until it fits a specific little tiny space and whatnot, it seems to me that there's a perspective that gets lost that, you know, it's just basically fitting there. When in fact, the structure of the brain material, the shape, the geometry of it, has a lot to do with how the brain performs. The structure and the shape and the geometry and the dimensionality of what we would use in, you know, tomorrow's performing computing has just much to do of its ability to perform this sophisticated task as a material that we choose. In that sense, that shape becomes a form or part of the intelligent structure.
Sort of embodied intelligence, if you think of it.
Yes. Though in itself, it does not tell you much, but as a collective whole, it actually has something to do with the performance of this machine, if you will.
You talk a lot about the brain. How important is it to really understand the brain to be able to do artificial intelligence?
I think it's of great significance. I think until about 100 years ago, some of the greatest minds of the last century have thought that its antenna that communicate was God, or the cooling device that just cools the blood. We really don't have a substantial volume of knowledge to the significance of this amazing organ. If we are to treat the brain as a unit of data processing or information processing, it becomes a challenge to answer the question of, well, why is it implicated in the formation of human intelligence? In examining the diseased mind in areas of disorder, he found some very intriguing facts, some very intriguing insights on what this organ is able to construct. In cases of schizophrenia or the spectrum of affective disorder, you find a level of consistent logic in linguistic expression of these patients. In the cases of the general mood assessment of any human being or any intelligent being that is capable of expressing natural language or fabricating natural language of their own, that even so, that the state of the mind, the emotion, it is embodied in that language. That the language itself is inherently based on physics.
How so?
In the expression of language, we find structures that without it, an idea does not exist. Language is essentially almost like the DNA of our emotion. Each specific person within a value system, and we have published a paper on that topic with a group at University of Geneva, where we look at the axiological value of the given language down to what we call an emotional dictionary of the individual, where the same exact word conveys a particular meaning for an entire population of a particular spoken language, yet the value of this particular word varies in potency and impact, in expression of a state of the mind, depression, anxiety, euphoria, etc., from one individual to another. we cannot ignore the organ that is capable of that fabrication. Paradoxically, the majority of thinkers on the mind created that separation to the point of attempting to fabricate the construct of the mind as a machine, ignoring fundamentally that the mind is a product that presides on a substrate called the brain. Yet we can touch and see and manipulate and in some way monitor the chemistry and the biochemistry of that structure. Yet to be able to see the mind, we cannot. We can actually sense its manifestation, but we cannot physically see it. So it is really of great significance that we understand a lot about the brain, about cognition, about the emergence of consciousness. Our current approach of doing research on the brain clearly accept the separation that the human brain is endowed with unique qualities that appears structurally different from any other form of life.
To what extent do you want to dive down? I mean, do you want to model each synapse, or is this really more an abstract way of looking at the problem?
So a central interest of mine is to essentially dive not only to the level of synapse, but actually even below that, even to the level of a molecular language. How is it that a pattern of light, sound, touches, and properties that sensed from a surrounding environment impacts the reaction that we have, to generate emotion, to manifest us through expressions of a similar patterns, of a similar simple languages. How is it that various energy scales that enter into that structure is transduced into various multi-sensory utilization and yet return back recognition from multi-dimensional world to a three-dimensional world or to a three-dimensional structure that in some anomaly way it was discovered that when processing a vision it seems to reintegrate things internally to the structure to give us the stereo and the dimensionality that is needed, yet has very, very elegant and simple way of processing this data. But we don't know that.
So you mentioned an emotional dictionary. What would that be?
So the proposed argument that in a given language, a natural language that is, each individual develops a unique value system to the same exact set of words that another individual are communicating. Take, for example, love and hate. While we agree on the contextual value, the meaning of that of these two words, to an individual, it might be on a unitary structure of velocity of the thought. It would range from a certain level of emotion to another person. And the embodiment of that, it can be captured in the linguistic expression that comes in your throughout your normal day-to-day activity. And that, in fact, one of the things that we worked on is to exploit that discovery, which isn't really that new, into a form of a systemic assessment tool to do mood state indicators for a person, a normal person, as well as a diseased mind and whatnot. And we actually made that system available It's called Lexio, linguistic lexiology is input-output system. So that two-pound enigma of white and gray matter is actually the manufacturer of this form of intelligence, is the manufacturer of this form that express conscious awareness is for us.
For the diseased mind, are you hoping that understanding the brain will actually help you a lot in the medical field as well?
Yes, it is an absolute goal of mine and a number of the researchers at MMP and the collaborators to direct most of our discoveries initially or implement them in medical fields. I myself was unfortunate to have some medical problems and damage to my brain, the visual center. I actually had to live practically all my life with dyslexia and learn several techniques and ways to defeat that disability, and hopefully we can implement some of this technology to sort of make life more comfortable for people that have these problems.
How would that work? Would that be a mix between an artificial and a real system?
Yes. So the Lexi system was designed actually to react to a specific need. In describing the problem space, would make more sense to the audience is that when a patient, a psychiatric patient, or a patient of a neurological disorder visits a practitioner, one of the tests is to identify these deficits, in you know, these cognitive deficits, and emotional state, and it's typically addressed through that exchange, the language exchange, the conversation between the doctor and the patient. And on the basis of that, then the doctor conclude the mood of that individual and assign the particular indicators of clinical states. So understanding the mood is of great importance. So we use some of the current AI techniques, only informed by our current knowledge of what we know in natural language, what manifests intelligence, what we know about common sense, what we know about the codification of emotion and state of mind, to support the physicians and practitioners. We also looked at another system where in one of the methodologies that current also school psychiatry or doctors of psychiatry utilize is called the pharmacotherapy. And in the pharmacotherapy, most practitioners know that they have a set of pharma solutions, and this pharma solution gets to be tried out on the patient. So essentially, it's an experimental process, not really a concrete process, but it's focused enough. I mean, they certainly know what treatment strategy or therapy or which generation of medicine they're going to use. But in the case of a project like Brain Space, we were able to take what we know today about the various pharma compounds, how they interact together, how they contradict together, and allow the practitioner to see from in a visualized way. So the doctor is not expected to see with that level of resolution, but we were able to give them a simple tool that captures the expert knowledge and the expert behavior of these molecules and be able to render that real-time and inform that communication between him and the patient. In doing so, between these set of tools, you're able to reduce treatment cycles by a substantial amount of time, and increase the confidence of that patient, which, in my opinion, has a lot to offer the treatment and the treatment pathway.
So that's really on the side of diagnostics, not on augmenting or anything like that.
So on the side of augmenting, where are we today? Today we planting probes and electrodes to discover neurocorrelation. We're doing images to process. So most of the technology, I would classify them as a read-only technology, and not just intelligent reading, but just, you know, merely being able to discover the surface, listen to the noise. Hopefully, we can make sense of it all. In the class of research that we work in it was what we're calling brain augmentation. We are hoping actually to be able to read and write to the brain. Essentially, we actually, I would say we are onto a very interesting set of refined understanding of the neural code that very, very soon, in days, not months, we will be able to publish some results that would shed some very interesting insights on how to write to the brain. See, when you write to something, that something has to understand your language. And in order for you to write to that something, you need to communicate in its language. So we are hoping to achieve that. Historically, history actually give us the best example of that. The best access to the human brain is language. So the intelligent manifestation of the human brain is the very tool that can access and alter the brain.
What kind of demonstrator do you want to have? What would you make that would be like, this is finally artificial intelligence?
So in the school of classic AI and what the Turing test and what, the Neuron architecture left us, is exactly that in order to demonstrate AI and in order to show AI, we must have this grand show and tell in the form of robotics, in the form of a test, in the form of that. I think that the best way to show that we understood the nature of intelligence and we were able to make sense and use of it. It's our continuous attempt to not reverse engineer what nature done best, but to learn from nature and to engineer at a very close proximity of the solution that is being offered by nature. It isn't one experiment or one grand challenge that will demonstrate to us the nature of intelligence or how to codify intelligence, but a set of concrete direction and paradigm shift and toolkits that will be available to everyone, including a child that knows nothing about computation at the level of computer science. And then seeing this tremendous offering available as a commonplace, just like the interaction between us and nature produce intelligence, produce a form of an intelligent being. And we will see a substantial amount of these tools and product and artifacts around us if our way of thinking about intelligence is being informed by the correct paradigm.
That's interesting because I think people don't know what to expect expects in an intelligent agent. So, for example, you have Watson, which did a beautiful performance on Jeopardy, the Google cars. I think people think these are intelligent. So, first of all, do you think these are intelligent, and what can you do to sort of compete so that people will find whatever comes out of this project as intelligent?
So, these are essentially elegant implementations of components or parts of what we think makes up human intelligence or natural intelligence. But how is it that, you know, again, going to the human brain, this, you know, 2-pound GUI with very limited power consumption is capable of doing things that Watson or the IBM experiments require a near nuclear reactor to achieve? And they haven't even begun to talk about human type modeling. How is it that the most diseased of brains is still capable of capacity and types of processing that none of these substantial machines can? Our strive should be toward that direction, that intelligence is manifested through the power efficiency, the material consumption, the computing power of various data sets, introduction in interaction of a completely different object or language that wasn't even introduced into the initial program. We don't intend to compete with certainly any of the resources of IBM or others who are approaching the problem space with certain solution perspective. But we do hope that our report card in humanity is marked by this small but meaningful insights into how we can refine and do what these giants like IBM is able to achieve. For example, in, you know, citing in the form of energy or in the type of processing or simply in being able to introduce variables that were never constructed or introduced into the initial program. That will not come by attempting to redo it, but just being able to influence that. So we see ourselves as a process thought leadership than it is somebody that's competing with another group.
All in all, what would be your hopes for the next 50 years of AI? What do you want to see come out of this? If you had to give one simple example, I know you don't like the demonstrator, but maybe, yeah, what do you hope to see develop in the next 50 years? Where will we be?
So for at least our goal, and hopefully in a lot less of a duration of time, we should be able to introduce some very intelligent nanostructures that would interface with that magnificent organ, the brain, and be able to influence that fabrication and the process of intelligence, whether that may be an augmentation to an already highly structured mind, or an augmentation to a disabled faculty that needed that brain prosthetic. That's what we refer to it as, a class of brain prosthetic. And for my group, the resources that we are allocated would be directed toward a meaningful goal like that, that actually does something for humanity. Because when you look at the contribution of the modern century or even before that, some of the most brilliant scientists of our times really needed the support of technology, be that it's prosthetic for translating the motion, the physical body movement, to being able to articulate their thoughts, like in Professor Hawkins' case of disability. And if we're able to do this more more intelligent, more efficient, in ways that is less notable, I think that would be a significant contribution and achievement for our team.
Thanks, Newton, for being here with us on Robots.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for today's episode. As always, if you want more information about the Mind Machine Project or any of our other episodes, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. Join us again in 2 weeks' time. Until then, goodbye. Create Intelligent Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.